Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome everyone to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
This week on the pod, younger children are now eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine shot. Some healthcare workers in Hamilton are fired for refusing to be vaccinated. There'll be a public inquiry into the hot mess that is Ottawa's $2 billion Confederation Light Rail Transit line. The Auditor General has released a report on how well the government is following its own environmental policies. Spoiler alert, not too well. And the Ontario Liberals have an idea on how to encourage you to buy winter tires for your car or truck. It's Tuesday, November 23rd, 2021, so let's get to it. Well, we already know that almost 90% of eligible Canadians are vaccinated, which is among the highest percentage of any nation in the world. But now there's the probability that even more among us will take the jab. JMM, tell us about why the government is encouraging 5 to 11-year-olds to get vaccinated now.
It's the news that I've been waiting for since this all started. My own kid is finally eligible to get a vaccine for COVID, and so is any other child born on or before December 31st, 2016. Their parents can register them for shots on the provincial vaccination portal as of 8 a.m. This morning, Tuesday morning. Unlike the experience we all had earlier this year of waiting for our turn in the queue as vaccine supplies came in, you know, week by week, Ontario is going to have enough doses for every eligible child, all 1 million or so, by the end of this week. And the government is really hoping that parents do sign up in large numbers, since about one third of new COVID-19 cases these days are coming from school-aged children, and the vaccines will both help protect kids and hopefully control the spread of the virus.
Okay, you mentioned any child born in 2016, even if they aren't 5 years old right now, they'll be eligible for this vaccine. Just because I want to make trouble here, what happens to kids who are born, let's say, January 1st, 2017? Are they eligible?
That's an interesting question. Solicitor General Sylvia Jones was asked about what is the prospect for 2017 babies on Monday morning, and she initially said that kids who are born in, for example, August of 2017 will be eligible as of January 1st. And then a few hours later, the government had to retract that statement. They walked it back and said, actually, they'll be following the data on vaccines as it evolves over the coming weeks and months. Not a great way to start the government's week, a bit of a communication snafu there. I know it upset a lot of parents. I watched this all unfold on social media. So as it stands now, if your kid is born on January 1st and they turn 5 on January 1st of 2022, I suspect they'll be able to get their Pfizer shot. If they're born on February 1st or March 1st, we just don't know at the moment. And I have my suspicions, but I kind of don't want to disappoint any more parents than I have to right now.
Including yourself. Now, your kid's under the wire, though, right? She's okay?
Right. My daughter just turned 6, so she's in the clear, and she doesn't know it yet, but she's going to be meeting a needle as soon as I can arrange it.
Good for you. Okay. Now, presumably, and again, I think an obvious question here, there will be enough doses coming in order to satisfy this new cohort, I presume.
Yes. So at least for the kids who are immediately eligible, we're going to be well stocked by the end of the week, at least for first doses. The government is spacing out second doses more than they had with more than the manufacturer requires. The government will be spacing out first and second doses by 8 weeks. So that will also have the benefit of giving them time to get more supply in for those second doses. There's going to be lots of supply, lots of different ways to get the needles in arms. But just in case, Vaccine Hunters Canada, you remember them from earlier this year, the social media team of volunteers. They helped many people find their doses earlier this year. They are getting back in the saddle for one more big push. So between schools, hospitals, family practitioners, and now Vaccine Hunters Canada, folks will have a number of options for getting their younger kids vaccinated in coming days.
Not only do I remember them, but I noticed that Toronto Life magazine, who when they do their sort of top 50 most influential people in the capital city every year, it's almost always the premier or the mayor or some, you know, billionaire or something like that. This year, and the edition I think just came out this weekend, Vaccine Hunters Canada was number one. So they have done good and important work over the last 19 months, so they're getting some deserved recognition. Oh, and you might tell your daughter as well, not that she knows who I am, she will not be the only one getting the needle in the next little while because I'm going for my booster shot right after we finish recording this.
Hey,
I am apparently as a double AstraZeneca guy, and my last shot having taken place 6 months ago, I'm now eligible for a booster shot. So I'm going to go get it right after this.
You are indeed eligible. At the moment, it's people who have had two shots of AstraZeneca, people who are over 70, Indigenous people, and healthcare workers. Anybody who's 6 months out from their second dose is eligible. I know that the government is planning to expand that eligibility further. I think if you just go by the six-month mark, I would be eligible by early or mid-December, but they haven't opened up my age cohort yet.
Yeah, you're not over 70. Even I'm not over 70 yet, even though I act it most of the time. But anyway, that's another story. Let's stay on this topic and talk about the post-secondary world, because there have been college and university students who, I think it's fair to say, have taken up the vaccine challenge extremely well. About 99% of post-secondary students are vaccinated, which, of course, they have to be if they want to attend classes on campus. But 99% is not 100%, and there are some students who just for whatever reason won't do it, and this did become an issue the other day at Western University in London.
That's right. A young male student insisted on going to class despite not having been vaccinated and despite not having a medical exemption. I can say I only made perfect and sterling life choices when I was a young man in university.
He said with no tongue-in-cheek at all. Yes, right.
I mostly didn't make my mistakes other people's problems, though. apparently, this student had done this several times, and finally, the university called in security and had him forcibly removed. You know, this video clip went a bit viral on social media. This is obviously a last-ditch solution for any post-secondary institution. But the student in question here said he didn't need to be vaccinated because even if he got COVID, it was highly unlikely that it was going to kill him, and so he preferred to take his chances. Of course, left unstated here is the fact that if he did get COVID, he isn't just taking his chances. He might pass it on to other people who aren't 22. You know, he could spread it to, you know, grandparents or people in their 60s or older, people who have much more serious consequences from getting COVID, who also can be bopping around university campuses. And we know that 98% of COVID deaths have taken place among those who are over 60 in Ontario. So again, not the greatest life choices when we're that age. Perhaps he had not considered all that yet.
Indeed. Let's follow up with another COVID story, this one out of Hamilton. We've been telling you for several weeks now that the head of Hamilton Health Sciences, which is the corporation that runs most of the hospitals in Hamilton, they've insisted that all healthcare workers be vaccinated or else those workers, the unvaccinated, will be fired. And about 98% of workers are vaccinated. But for those that refused, well, fill us in, JMM. Time's up for them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hamilton Health Sciences has fired 6 staff members and disciplined 52 others, even though the deadline of November 30th actually hasn't technically arrived yet. The reason the hospital system did this is because those who haven't been vaccinated are supposed to disclose their vaccination status and be tested twice a week, but they weren't doing even that. At Joseph Brandt Hospital in nearby Burlington, they're taking a similar approach. 13 staff were fired and 38 have been put on unpaid leave again for what is effectively insubordination.
We should say the head of Hamilton Health Sciences is a guy named Rob McIsaac, who's a former politician. So the guy understands, I guess, a little something about leadership, making a decision and sticking to it. And he has, and he's getting a lot of very positive attention in the Hamilton press for taking that position. There are healthcare facilities in this province which have not taken this step, presumably because replacing those healthcare workers would be harder. But we should remind everybody, this is, John Michael, the hospital's decision to make, right?
That's correct. The government did not make this decision for them. The government has opted not to make it mandatory for healthcare workers to get the vaccine, which effectively, you know, tosses the political problem, the management problem, back to hospital CEOs. You know, it's different in long-term care, where all workers have until December 13th to be fully vaccinated and prove their fully vaccinated status to their employer, or else they will be fired. But, you know, that is a deadline that has already been extended. Workers were not rushing to get vaccinated. So, you know, we could still see a showdown between the government and the relatively small percentage of long-term care workers who are still refusing to get vaccinated. And looking at the calendar, you're potentially looking at another showdown with long-term care at the center of a political scandal, whatever you want to call it, right before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Tick tock, as they say. Well, let's check in with one more group of workers, and that is apparently there are some employees of the TTC, the Toronto Transit Commission. This is the organization that runs the subways, the streetcars, the buses, Wheel-Trans. They are refusing to take the needle, some of them, and the union representing TTC workers took the case to court and asked the judge to put the TTC's plan on hold. But the judge sided with the commission instead. What's that all about?
Right. So this basically means that the TTC management now has the authority to suspend or fire workers who won't get vaccinated. But this isn't the end of the line for this dispute. Apparently, the Transit Workers Union, they are entitled under Ontario labor law to grieve this decision. So they have applied to bring this to arbitration. They were asking the judge to pause everything until an arbitrator could rule. The judge declined to. This will go before an arbitrator who will decide the final issue, whether this is a reasonable thing for management to do, and the union will get its chance there to stand up for its members, its workers who don't want to be vaccinated.
So let's go up to, as they say, 30,000 feet now and take a look at the many different kinds of workers that we've been talking about here, a small percentage of whom, and we remind everybody, it's a small percentage of people who don't want to get vaccinated. Why do you suppose the province of Ontario doesn't simply say, if you're paid from the public purse, if you have significant interactions with the public, you must be vaccinated or else you're fired? Why are they not taking that step?
You know, it's an interesting question because, you know, the government is taking a different approach depending on who you are. Long-term care workers must get vaccinated, right? This is, you know, the sector where we've seen the highest death count relative to its population. These are people who deal with the frail elderly in congregate care. So, you know, the government has said, yes, you have to get vaccinated there. I will say it took the government a while to get to that position, but they did get there. Hospital workers, though, people who also frequently deal with people who have, you know, weakened immune systems or other conditions that might make them particularly vulnerable to COVID, and yet the government is not requiring them to be vaccinated. Transit workers, yes, but only because the Transit Commission says so, not a provincial mandate. And we could look at school boards, where school boards have adopted their own policies. And this, I think, sort of helps illustrate some of the problems, right? We just learned this week, the Toronto District School Board, nearly 300 staff had been given temporary exemptions from the board's vaccine policy because they need to fill roles that aren't easy to replace, things like special needs education positions. I think this shows you, or it helps illustrate what the government is concerned about. Being stuck with a really critical staff shortage that the government sort of induces on itself with these vaccine policies. I think there's a reasonable argument about whether the government's fears about losing critical workers are maybe being exaggerated, because Premier Ford was quite public about the fact that he didn't really want to impose vaccine requirements. He took a long time to get to requiring vaccine certificates, that kind of thing. Doesn't really love these coercive measures, but whatever I think about the actual severity of the problem, this is, I think, the government's stated reason for it. They're worried about causing these workforce shortages in a province that, frankly, already has a lot of labor shortages.
300,000 unspoken for jobs in the province of Ontario right now. Quite astonishing. All right, let's turn our focus to the nation's capital, where the Confederation Line LRT has not only been a transportation fiasco, but it's now also become a significant political story as well. JMM, why has the Ontario government called a public inquiry into what's happening there?
So we'll give you some background for those of you listening who live outside of Ottawa. The LRT that is in place now is a $2.1 billion or so light rail line. It's the biggest infrastructure project in Ottawa's history, but it has had all sorts of mechanical problems. There have been, I believe, two derailments over the past few months. Nobody injured, thankfully, but they had to shut the whole train down for several weeks. It caused all sorts of transit chaos in the nation's capital, in one of Ontario's biggest cities. It has become a huge political story because the derailments recently were only sort of the most recent and most severe problems. The train has also, you know, had trouble running in cold weather. And as somebody who was born in Ottawa, I will tell you that Ottawa gets cold pretty reliably.
You don't say.
Yeah, yeah. They've got a whole canal that they like to skate on. It's a big deal. And so it's causing huge political problems for the mayor of Ottawa, Jim Watson, who has been quite popular. He was also an MPP before he was mayor. He was also a city councillor before that. So, you know, he's served at multiple levels of government. But this was also his project. This was a project he was elected to really push through. He has been reelected repeatedly to get this project going. And so it is kind of his baby. And now he's wearing the mess, for better or worse. That said, last week, Transportation Minister Caroline Mulroney announced a public inquiry to get to the bottom of why there have been so many problems with this LRT.
We haven't had a Bill Davis reference yet, John. John Michael, do you think we should do that right here?
Could I stop you if I wanted to?
Well, here's the Bill Davis reference. The former Premier of Ontario and the current Mayor of Ottawa share the same birthday. So there you go, July 30th. I knew everybody was hanging on the edge of their seats to know that information, so I'm putting it in right here before we get any further into this conversation.
You know, I appreciate that one. I like that one.
Well, now, okay, back on the path now, and I presume part of the problem for the nation's capital is that they are actually supposed to build a second phase of this LRT project, which is twice as expensive as the first phase. And it hardly makes sense to embark on a $4 billion project if you can't figure out how to keep phase one in good operating order, I presume.
Exactly. So, you know, we're going to watch in the weeks ahead for the government to establish the inquiry, name a commissioner, figure out which questions need answering, and they're going to set the terms of reference for the inquiry. That'll, you know, really give us a sense of what the government, what questions the government is looking to answer, and, you know, ensure that this is all resolved before billions more dollars are spent on phase two. And of course, this isn't just an Ottawa story, because Ottawa isn't the only place that is building an LRT right now. We've got two light rail projects underway in Toronto, another in Mississauga, and your hometown of Hamilton is finally getting closer to building an LRT after a few years of drama. So, you know, it's definitely worth learning whatever lessons we can.
And I have to say, unlike in other cities where they're building LRTs right now, there is a real split in Hamilton as to whether or not it makes sense to do it. And I note there was a letter in the Hamilton Spectator, I think just yesterday or the other day, saying, if you think it's a smart idea to build an LRT in Hamilton, just look at what's going on in Ottawa. They're having terrible problems. We shouldn't do it here. Anyway, you're quite right. This is not just an Ottawa story. It has tentacles well beyond that. All right, let's stay with transportation for another item here. The Liberal leader in Ontario, Stephen Del Duca, has announced that if he is successful in winning the next election, next June, next year, he'll offer Ontarians a tax credit to help them buy winter tires for their cars, trucks, minivans, whatever. What's the thinking here?
I mean, it's confusing to me because I don't think voters in June are going to be thinking about snow tires, but maybe Stephen Del Duca knows something I don't. You know, this was presumably an issue that Del Duca knew something about, given that he was transportation minister when the Liberals were last in power. There are innumerable studies that show that when people switch from summer tires to winter tires, once the weather gets bad, that saves lives. It makes roads safer for everyone. You have fewer accidents, fewer injuries, and of course, fewer fatalities when you switch to the deeper treads for wintertime.
We should point out Quebec mandates this. You have to have winter tires on your vehicle during the wintertime in Quebec or you face a fine. Del Duca has, however, said he will not take that approach in the province of Ontario if he's successful next June. How come?
You know, this is all about the right mix of carrots and sticks. Del Duca said he would prefer to encourage people to get winter tires, so he is offering a tax credit for those that do. You never know how much uptake there will be on these things, but if it's a decent amount, Del Duca figures it'll cost the Treasury $80 million, which, you know, in a provincial budget of $190 billion or so, it's a pretty modest sum of money compared to the health of drivers and their passengers and auto repair costs. You know, these things all have real costs on the economy, too.
Now, Del Duca made the announcement last week on Zoom, and I did watch the announcement, and you could see during the course of it that he was not just making an announcement specifically about tires, but he was road testing some campaign ideas as well. For example, when he was asked why not make it mandatory, as we just discussed, he talked about keeping life affordable in Ontario, thus the encouragement to buy winter tires, but not a law forcing people to do it. Affordability. JMM, affordability. Get ready to hear a lot more from all the parties on that issue in the months to come.
Well, and you've already heard Premier Ford talk about how he still wants to keep his party's promise to lower gasoline taxes. I think that, between Ford and Del Duca, you're hearing in particular about the affordability of driving right now. And I suspect we are going to hear more about not just driving, but affordability in other topics. Certainly a lot of people talking about inflation right now. We'll see whether that remains a electoral issue with any kind of power 6 months from now.
Indeed. Let's do one more item here, and that is the Auditor General's Office released this year's audits of the province's environmental policies. Our listeners might remember that this used to be the job of the Environmental Commissioner, but the Ford government shut down the Environmental Commissioner's office. One of the first things they did when they came into power in 2018, they folded that work into the Auditor's Office, allegedly as a cost-saving measure. Well, okay, here we are, Auditor General Bonnie Lissick and the Assistant Auditor General and Environmental Commissioner Tyler Schultz have issued their annual report on the government's environmental policies. What kind of mark did the government get this time?
Not an A plus. Let's put it that way. This year's report finds the government is not taking the risks to endangered species terribly seriously, with permits that harm animals or their habitats being issued very frequently. It also finds that the province is very likely to miss its 2030 targets for waste diversion. This is like trying to keep things out of landfills with recycling or composting. It is very likely to miss its 2030 targets, and it could see the province's existing landfill capacity filled up within 14 years. Lissick and Schultz also report that the government isn't taking its responsibilities under the Environmental Bill of Rights seriously. This is the law that requires the government to post potential policy changes for public consultation and be very transparent about its environmental policies. This is obviously not like great news for any government, and I think every government in Ontario always braces when the Auditor General has a press conference. But the report was also pretty clear that several of these problems are much older than just the Ford government. This goes back many, many years.
And just to be clear, this is not the last we will hear from the Auditor General's office this year?
Right. There's the traditional annual report from her office, which is a very large document, usually, 300 to 400 pages. And it just details all sorts of things from ministries and programs and where there's either waste or abuse or misspending. That is still to come later this year. It reliably causes a headache for whoever's in government. On the other hand, gives reporters and opposition politicians something to feast on for a day.
That reminds me of an old story. Do we have time for a little story here?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a cub reporter, so that means even younger than you. I think I was in my early 20s, and I had to cover the auditor's report being unveiled at Queen's Park, and I went to cover this report, and I put a couple of examples of, malfeasance and badly run programs and all that, and then I tagged my report by saying, but on balance, the auditor thinks that the province's books are being well attended to and government is basically being run pretty well. And I got back to the station, and after I recorded that, I think the senior reporter came up to me and said, you know what, don't ever do that again. This is the one day a year where we all get to pile on the government, and you're not allowed to say that they're doing a pretty good job. It's all got to be bad news. So I guess I learned my lesson on that day.
You don't give good news on the bad news day.
There you go. Took me a little while to figure it out, but I think I got it straight now. Well, we always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, and we'll have those for you immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We do love your feedback, good, bad, or indifferent.
You can also shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here now, my quote of the week, and you know that the Alberta government just signed a child care agreement with the feds. That despite the fact that Premier Jason Kenney and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau aren't exactly what you'd call bosom buddies. So it again raised the question of, why no agreement in Ontario yet? Premier Doug Ford addressed that a few days ago in Etobicoke.
I'm just not going to make a deal for the sake of making a deal. We're seeing these deals signed, as you mentioned, that they're more per capita with less strings attached. And my good friend Francois, he got a great deal, no strings attached, or minimum strings attached. So we'll sit down. We've been negotiating for a couple months. I want a deal. But I also expect the local mayors, be it Mayor Tory or other mayors, to stand united with us. I expect the federal MPs, the Liberal federal MPs, to stand with us. They represent half their caucus. So we'll strike a deal, but I'm not making a bad deal just for the sake of making a deal.
That's Premier Ford pointing out his good friend Premier François Legault got a good deal for Quebec, and he'll be holding out for a good one for Ontario. Only Ontario and New Brunswick, well, they're the only jurisdictions in Canada at the moment without childcare agreements.
And here's my quote of the week. And as I said, you know, I'm a parent of a child who's now eligible to get vaccinated. So this might actually just be my quote of the year. Here's Federal Minister of Procurement Philomena Tassi speaking on Friday.
This morning, we heard the good news that Health Canada has authorized Pfizer-BioNTech's COVID-19 vaccine for children between the ages of 5 and 11. As we announced last month, Canada and Pfizer agreed to an accelerated delivery schedule for the COVID-19 vaccine for children once it received regulatory authorization. With the authorization announced today, I can now confirm that Canada will begin receiving doses Sunday, with all the 2.9 million doses received by the end of next week.
Not only is she the MP for Hamilton West, Ancaster, Dundas, but Canada's first pediatric Pfizer doses landed at the John C. Munro International Airport in Hamilton on Sunday evening. I know you'd be cross with me if I didn't mention the Hamilton connection, Steve.
That is absolutely correct. We must, I believe it is an edict of the Ontario Cabinet. We must have either a Hamilton or a Bill Davis reference in everything we do. And thankfully in this podcast, JMM, we had both. So thank you for continuing the tradition.
Got to keep the team going.
Amen. That is this week's episode of the On Poly Podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, edited by Matthew O'Mara, production support from Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell. JMM, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.